Welcome to another podcast of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. And as I'm trying to do more often, I want to remind people that there is a now rather large archive of Expanding Minds on PRN, on Podbean, and on my own website, Technosis. And if you want to check out the five most recent shows on your phone, you can call the Expanding Mind phone number 1-701-719-0890, 701-719-0890. I've been thinking a lot about my native state of California recently. One of the very, very few silver linings of our new president-to-be and his hall of his cabinet of monsters is that it made me turn around and look at where I actually live with a brighter light than I have as someone who has come to be somewhat grumpy about the development of San Francisco in recent years and the role of the technology industry in the state and changes in culture, yada, yada, yada. It nonetheless is very heartening to live in a place where the city's Board of Supervisors issued a really remarkable and quite spot-on sort of rebuttal in advance to any federal moves that might come out of the various points of view that our new administration is going to put forward or is likely to put forward. Really kind of brings to mind that this is a different place, that California is not like the rest of the country, not always in great ways, but often in great ways, and that it's important to recognize it as kind of its own, not an island separate from the country, because, of course, you know, it's part of the country and part of, you know, helping to keep alive the more progressive dreams that so many people across the country hold. But it's a visible carrier of that now in a way that I hope shores up and intensifies local and statewide movements to keep California on the relatively good track that it's been on, given all the challenges. And part of that spirit, of course, isn't just about progressive politics, but it's also about sort of attitudes towards culture and towards consciousness. I mean, there's been a remarkable, bizarre, wild, wonderful, and sometimes deeply weird culture of consciousness pursuit, of novelty, of avant-garde experience, whether you want to call it spiritual or artistic or bohemian or whatever. It's really a remarkable legacy that continues to shape the contemporary world in all sorts of ways. And that current in California was also tragically brought to national and global consciousness this week with the horrible fire in at the Ghost Ship in Oakland. And it's been really very challenging wrestling with that, because it's, you know, well, I did not personally know anybody. I recognized faces, and they were the people who died in that terrible fire were parts of communities that are part of my world. So it struck very close to home, but it also made me think again about the role of avant-garde, informal, ad hoc, sometimes dangerous, sometimes distinctly illegal forms of living and being that are part of that California current and are so vital to this state. So without getting more into the details of that particular tragedy, it just once again reminded me about the particularities of California culture, which leads me to our happily more upbeat topic of the podcast today, which is the remarkable California character, Eden Abes. He's best known for writing the song Nature Boy, recorded by Nat King Cole in 1947. But if you go online and go onto YouTube and I think you can still find it there. There's remarkable footage of a big celebration of this huge hit song. You know, it went on and Frank Sinatra did it, Miles Davis did it. I mean, lots of people, Peggy Lee, tons of people recorded this tune, especially in the 1950s. It was really a signature song, and we'll get to more of it in a little bit. But if you go on and you see a little celebration about the song with Nat King Cole and all the people gathered in Los Angeles, and then they have Eden Abbez, the composer, walk on stage, and you go, oh my God, it's 1947 or 48, and that guy's a hippie. You know, long hair, long robes, bare feet, and it's not just a garb. It's like the dude is living that way. So he's a remarkable character. And to tell us more about Eden and his music, to celebrate and talk about the new recording of Rarities, composed and sometimes performed by Eden, is the pop culture art critic Brian Chittister, who is really a wonderful writer and has been digging into the kind of hidden histories of California characters and other avant-garde characters for many years now. I've been reading his writing for quite a long time, and he's also the author, or one of the authors of Pop Surf Culture, a really wonderful book about not just actual surfing, but more the music and design and ethos and everything around the whole bohemian surf scene in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, mostly. I'm very happy to have Brian on the show, and welcome to Expanding Mind.
Thanks, Eric. Happy to be here.
Yeah, excellent. Well, hopefully it'll work out. Last time we tried to do this, the whole system went down. So hopefully the gremlins will keep away this time. I want to get to Eden's music and talk about Nature Boy in the first place. But still, I thought it'd be more fun to kind of take a little step back. And since you've done so much research on his life and the kind of California undergrounds that shaped him and that he helped invent. I'd love to know a little bit more, like why, how is it possible that I, you know, turn on this film clip from the late 40s and see this guy who just looks exactly like a hippie? Like what makes that happen in the early part of the 20th century in California? Was he making it up? Did he have friends? Where did it come from?
That's a good question. I think for Eden, displacement played a large role in it. He and people who knew him before Nature Boy often talk about him being of a very esoteric demeanor throughout his young life. But he was actually born in Brooklyn, and he grew up until the age of 8 in the Brownsville district of Brooklyn, which was 99% Jewish at the time, very poor community. And his parents had 9 kids, and 4 of them were orphaned off, Eden and his twin sister at the age of 8. And they were taken on orphan trains in about 1917 out to the Midwest in Kansas and raised by a Protestant family. And early on, Eden, who was then named George McGrew, ran away from home a lot. They would find him, like, sleeping down by the lake. And he had this kind of very spiritual, esoteric demeanor. But he had also been educated in the Hebrew schools in New York and then later in the public school system as a musician. And so he had that talent, and he started, you know, basically when he was 18, he started freight train hopping and hitchhiking. And this was the era of the Great Depression. And he started picking up different things as he was going across the country. And he famously told friends when he got to California later that he had walked and hitchhiked across the country 8 times before he settled in California in the early 1940s. And so, you know, he was picking up things along the way. But I recently came across an article from 1956 written by a friend of his in the newspaper. And Eden had told him that, you know, he got really, really sick in Miami and nearly died. And it was during that kind of near-death experience that he decided to not necessarily live so much as a hobo, but somebody who could sort of celebrate the poverty that seemed almost impossible for him to overcome at that point. And so he started trying to find ways of taking poverty and learning how to live in more healthy ways, both mentally and physically. And the great benefit came to him when he was in California, that there was this new influx in the 1940s of guru culture, of German health, doctors and people who were into primitive living. And so this was all throughout, like, downtown Los Angeles, the new areas in Hollywood, but particularly out in the desert towns. There were, you know, a lot of different gurus and health seekers from Germany that were out there. Out in Santa Monica, you had Yogananda. Out in the Santa Monica area, he had an ashram there. And just up the coast in Ojai was Krishnamurti was giving various lectures at the time. So Eden was really taking all this in, and he was coupling it with the fact that he was a very talented musician naturally. And so he was stockpiling songs and slowly getting them published in 1945, 1946, and shopping around the sheet music, you know, basically coming out of the Hollywood Hills in his bicycle, just like you see him on that television clip, and hand-delivering sheet music of Nature Boy and other songs to different celebrities that had recording contracts. And Nat King Cole at that time had the open-door policy in that he would receive anything that was given to him, and he would give it a look through. And his manager, Carlos Gaston, later wrote that, you know, Nat at that time was really looking to get out of the basic jump blues that he performed, you know, on Capitol Records through most of the war years, and looking to do some stuff that was more ethnic. You know, there was a whole generation that had come back from World War II in the South Pacific, and there was this, you know, sort of fetishization of South Pacific culture and exotic culture. And so you have kind of the beginning of exotica there. Les Baxter was recording some of his first music in the late 40s, early 50s. So Nat Cole was looking for a song like that, and he found this very exotic Hebrew-inflected song, Nature Boy, and he recorded and went to number one for 8 weeks in a row. And that was really the beginning for Abi. And I think now historians are starting to look back and say that was the beginning of the hippie movement and psychedelic culture.
I want to play the version of Nature Boy that's on the record that you so painstakingly curated and that's just coming out on Bear Family, the Wild Boy, the Lost Songs of Eden Abes. But before that, I just want to spend a little bit more time talking about kind of his quote unquote lifestyle, which is sort of a crappy word because it makes it sound so consumerist. And he's like this ultimate example of anti-consumerism. So he comes out of this hobo scene. He's used to living on the road. He's used to living in poverty or making his way in those domains, comes to California, encounters this whole already existing culture that sort of melds holistic living, spirituality, and what we will now see is kind of like, you know, it's like the current, you know, obsessions with raw food and the paleo diet. Like, that's not new. Like, people have been thinking that way for, you know, well over a century, at least in California, where there's been health movements and the idea of returning to the natural and getting out of the modern city and getting more connected with nature and becoming healthy, but with this kind of spirituality of that. But he really lived it. So, I mean, could you talk about, like, so he's you know, he's riding his bicycle to bring in the song to Nat King Cole. But, like, what kind of world is he living in? Who are the other people he knows? What do they do out in the desert? Like, he's not just living in a little bungalow in Santa Monica. I mean, he's really carving out a different way of being in California.
Right. They're living ferally. They're living in Tockwitz Canyon inside the caves during the fall and winter because it's warmer out in the desert. And then they're coming down into Hollywood and into Tujunga during the spring and summer. During the spring and summer, and, you know, basically foraging, living very cheaply, living almost communally. One of the better known characters was Gypsy Boots, aka Robert Bootson, originally from San Francisco, another Jewish young seeker who came down to California, Southern California at the time, and again lived fairly out in the deserts. But there were others. There was probably a dozen or so young Nature Boys. They all sort of found each other, I guess, through their beards and their, you know, outsider lifestyle. They were all very poor, very, you know, esoteric thinkers, but I wouldn't call them necessarily elite. I don't think this stuff was coming out of, you know, the colleges at that time as it would later, as it is now. You know, in a way, I think whatever Albie learned and, you know, the other Nature Boys learned out in the deserts through some of the older figures that were coming, had come over from Germany earlier in the century, by the time it gets to the song Nature Boy and to him walking out on that stage, Abby's really, he's a man of the people. He's coming out of the New Deal era. He's thinking much more collectively. Nature Boy certainly touched a nerve with the public. And I think if you asked Abby about that, he'd have said it was purposeful. His interest to the very end was with the plastic arts, not with the approval of an elite class of critics and patrons, as was the case with other pre-hippie types like Moondog and Harry Parch, whose work ended up in concert halls. And that was essentially their aim from the outset. But with Abby, he was different. Even his last single in 1982, titled Divine Melody, has written in big letters on the cover, "For everyone," which I think kind of says it all. You know,
That's a really interesting distinction, because we do have these other kind of outsider characters. I mean, like you say, Harry Parch is a great example, West Coast Hobo, but he's so clearly avant-garde, or whatever you want to call it.
He
wasn't necessarily thinking of himself as a hipster, but he was definitely, you know, an artist on the edge of what most people would be able to listen to and accept. But Eden's got a really populist sensibility, and it's still to me remarkable that track it was so popular. And we're not going to play the Nat King Cole version. We're just going to play a short clip from the version of the tune that's on your collection by the Talbot Brothers. So let's just play that. It's just the beginning of the tune. Oh, I might have gotten that one mixed up there.
There was a boy, a very strange enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far, very far, over land and sea. A little shy and sad of eye, but very wise was he. And then one day, one magic day, he passed my way, and while we spoke of many things, fools and kings.
It's just such a haunting melody. That's what surprises me when I hear that. Like, I'm like, even the fact that it was recorded by Nat King Cole at all still kind of blows me away a little bit. Like, someone just said, "Hey, man, check this tune. That's from 1947. I'd be like, "Whoa, that's kind of spooky and weird and kind of ominous and spiritual and sweet and so meaningful." I mean, you get to these incredible lines later about, you know, I mean, things that, like, I think are about as true as you can possibly say in a pop song. What the only thing you'll ever learn is to love and be loved in return. You're like, well, that's pretty good. And yet it's this huge hit. And that's the part that still blows me mind. What's going on in American society in the late 40s that makes this strange, haunting tune so powerful?
Well, there's stories in the California Eagle, which was a black newspaper that was published down in the Watts district of Los Angeles at that time, that says that people would stop in front of television and radio stores when the song would come on, and they would weep. So they were, you know, a lot of people were really upset about the atrocities that were experienced during World War II, and a lot of people, there was growing concerns as the relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union were fraying and we're moving into a full-blown Cold War. You're inching closer to the Korean War. Kids are now being taught to fear, you know, the possibility of nuclear bomb dropping. You know, you see the famous footage from the time of kids ducking under their desks with the books on top of their head. And so, you know, the fact that this was written by somebody that was homeless and looked very different, it came across in some strange kind of alchemy as entirely sober. And I think, you know, you find that throughout Eden's life. There's a story from the 1970s where a policeman pulls him over for looking so bizarre. And in the early 1960s, pulls him over for looking so bizarre, and Eden tells a story that he tells the guy, some people look normal, but they're actually crazy, and some people look crazy, but they're actually normal. And the policeman says, "You know what, buddy, you're right," and he lets him go. So I think that's kind of, you know, the take home here with Avi is that he used the novelty of his personality and he put himself out there. He was willing to play the fool to sort of open the public's eyes in a way. And in that way, I think he very much fits the description of kind of a Quixote-like character. And in fact, in some of the songs that he did in the 1950s, he called himself things like the dreamer, the prophet, the shepherd, the fool. So a lot of these things that harken back to ancient spirituality and ancient literary tropes, but also kind of point forward to, you know, some of the demarcations and sentiments put forward by the Beatles or Pink Floyd or Jimi Hendrix or the hippie generation too. I mean, you know, he lands on that language early, but in fact, a lot of the conditions are relatively the same in terms of society and politics in the 1940s as they would be in the 60s. It just sort of took somebody, I think, to kind of say, you know, the world's looking pretty mad. And, you know, here's at least, you know, a first volley. Here's the first, you know, attempt at a solution. And, you know, Avi throughout his life really kept it simple in that regard. I don't think he was overtly political, per se. You know, I don't even know how much his message would really fit with today's political climate, particularly in liberalism and on the left, because I think he was really more of a racially transcendent humanist. He was, again, looking for something that applied to everybody.
I think you're right. I mean, it is a different moment. I mean, and I think that and there's also when you talk about the politics, it's almost more of a kind of, you know, anarcho libertarian in the non-business sense of the term, in the way. So it fits and it doesn't fit because, you know, he's also pursuing freedom. So there's a way in which he took advantage of being a marginal character to live incredibly free life, and that freedom was part of what was valuable about that life. So it wasn't, they weren't doing it because they had to. He could have, you know, as he eventually did, you know, get a normal house and raise a family and all that kind of stuff. They chose to do it and chose to kind of even celebrate and communicate that perspective. But it's almost more about like what you can do outside of society. So there was still an idea that there's sort of an outside that you can inhabit. And I think that idea is also really, really different. And it's a much more innocent time in terms of imagining a kind of global spirituality or a simple spirituality, a nature spirituality. This is before all of the green movement, environmentalism. It's before all the rise of the, you know, or not all of it, but most of the gurus and stuff that we'll see in the 60s and 70s. So when he sings a song about India or when he sings songs about, you know, Palm Springs, it's like there's a kind of freshness and space there. That's really just, you know, it's very, very different, but incredibly, incredibly prophetic. Now, how was he seen once the 60s kick in? You know, a lot of these tracks are from the 60s. Once it starts kicking in, then suddenly bohemianism is taken up by more and more young people. And then eventually, you know, and it starts getting circulated through Madison Avenue. And, it, you know, by the end of the decade, it's just kind of a new mutant part of American society. What was his life like? Was he recognized as a progenitor? Was he supported? Was he alienated? What happened to him when his kind of very, very unique, his unique way of being in the world began to be kind of replicated by so many people?
Well, he was all for it. And I think, you know, there are enough anecdotes that, you know, confirm the fact that the young movement was interested in him and was ready and willing to sort of celebrate the vocabulary that he was such a, you know, vital character in pioneering. You have pictures of him in 1967 with Brian Wilson during the Smile Sessions. There's the story that Donovan tells during his tour and stops in Los Angeles at the trip on the Sunset Strip, that he then heads out to Palm Springs to seek out Eden, and the two meet each other and they have a meeting of the minds, as it were. You know, Grace Slick does Nature Boy. Capitol psychedelic band called Gandalf does a version of Nature Boy. John Coltrane does a psychedelic, you know, free jazz version of Nature Boy in 67. Tom Waits told the story a few years ago of the first time he came to Los Angeles in 1968 as a hobo. Eden, you know, was the guy that drove him into town. But, you know, there are certain issues that sort of come up that preclude Eden from being, you know, 100% in the culture. In 1965, he's still doing shows as the Nature Boy Trio at the Insomniac Cafe in Hermosa Beach. But the year before, his wife had passed away she had bone cancer, and she died at the age of 44. So he was raising a son on his own, and his son Zoma took the death of his mother extremely hard by all reports, and as a teenager got heavily involved in drugs, and Zoma ended up committing suicide, or, you know, having a drug overdose on crystal meth in 1969. So at that point, Eden is really a broken man. You know, up to 65, 66, he was still copywriting 4, 5, 6 songs a year. There were still singles all the way up to 65. As Wild Boy shows, there was unreleased recordings all the way through the decade. But, you know, he really comes to a screeching halt. In 1971, there's a song on the Wild Boy album called The Clam Man that never came out. It was produced by a guy named Dave DeLaVega, who was an engineer at Cherokee Studios, and Wally Hyder in Hollywood at the time. And DeLaVega did put out one single of Abby's in 1971, Divine Melody, backed with Richard Milhouse. And pretty much after that, Abby sort of disappears. There's one other single in 1977 by an Armenian singer from Pasadena, Armenian American, and then he produces his own in 1982, and that's really it. I mean, and the odd thing, as I've gone back and done this research and met all kinds of people who knew Abby, is that he never really stopped recording. He you know, there's 24 recordings from the 70s and in the 80s and 90s after he wins some lawsuits through Nature Boy for back royalties owed, he records probably 300 or 400 songs that have never come out. So there's this vast amount of material that's still just sitting there waiting to find release. And but I don't think he really had the hunger to get out there and push it the way he had when he was young. He didn't have two mouths to feed anymore. He had just himself. And, you know, so in a way, like, you know, the culture that sort of existed, the established way of the music business, the established way of, you know, the established American dream, didn't really fit with him. And I think, you know, he tried, you know, to not reject it whole cloth. And he, you know, he did play a part in it. He went to the music industry to fund his lifestyle and whatnot. But I think in some ways it sort of, you know, it just let him down. And I think after those tragedies, he just was not really invested in getting his music out there as he was before.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, one of the other only other records that are out there that people can get on, you know, in reissue is Eden's Island, and that record is very exotica, and some of the tracks on Wild Boy have that exotica kind of spin. That was a real important kind of space for him, and it's something that I think gets sort of, you know, people sort of know it. It's a genre in the store and the reissues, and there's sort of a kind of goofy, ironic, you know, space age bachelor pad attitude that people have towards exotica, and it obviously has that element, you know, with whatever tiki cafes and the goofy stuff and the way that's, but it's been kind of appropriated by more modern hipsters. But it's a really rich, kind of complicated cultural zone, you know, that grows up in the West Coast following World War II. And you alluded to it a little bit before, but I wonder if you could talk about it a bit more, give us a little more context on how exotica was functioning, and particularly how Eden sort of used or transformed that space in the music on Eden's Island, but also on some of the tracks on Wild Boy.
Right. So, you know, according to Bob Wallace and Gypsy Boots, who were the two other gentlemen who joined Eden in the Nature Boy Trio, they were performing the songs on Eden's Island from 57 through 1959 in the coffee houses in Venice and in Hermosa Beach and around Southern California. And they were basically doing it with Eden on flute and doing the poetry, Bob Wallace on guitar and Gypsy Boots on maracas. And so, it was more of a coffee house thing. And then when Bob Keane of Delphi started recording Eden's Island in 1959, he brought in two cool jazz players, Paul Moyer, who was a pianist, and Emil Richards, who was a vibraphonist at the time. And they basically gave it kind of an arrangement that would fit with what was popular at the time, which was exotica. And it was kind of ethnic lounge music. It was, ersatz, Caribbean, Polynesian, Africana. And it was very bourgeois. It was basically, kind of weekend escapism. And I think, you could make a pretty definitive claim that Eden had nothing to do with those arrangements. And yet Eden's Island wasn't the only time that he was given the exotica treatment. There are other recordings from the mid-50s to the early 1960s where he's also arranged in an exotica style. And I think one of the reasons why that was because you didn't have this robust, cross-pollination that would have been happening in the mid to late 60s. There really wasn't anybody else like him. I mean, Gypsy Boots was not incredibly talented. He could shake a maraca and get a crowd going, and Bob Wallace or some of the other Nature Boys never really produced much themselves. So Eden was really kind of an island at that time, pun very much intended. But so what are you gonna do with this guy? I mean, I think he was really willing to say, okay, however you want to couch it, you can do. And so at the time, what they had was this whole beachcomber paradigm that was set up, and it was novelty and it was somewhat hokey, but he kind of wrapped his mind around the absurdity and the novelty of it all, and he found a way to really imbue it with a real sense of melancholy and a real sense of self-reflection and spirituality. And I think that comes across strongly in the Eden's Island album, particularly songs like The Wanderer and Full Moon, which has the famous line, I am everyone, anyone, no one. So, I just think there was a sort of a lack of a place to put a guy like that. What do you do with him? And it's not like the post-war generation didn't have dreams of free love and leisure and travel like the hippies did. They maybe just didn't go all the way. Again, it was kind of a weekender thing. And so for Eden, it was a full-on immersive lifestyle. But, the two, might have been an ill-fitting suit in hindsight. But at the time, it was sort of the only place that you could think to put him. And I think that's pretty much why he becomes, at least as a solo artist, almost exclusively exotica.
One of the things I like about, both those records, but really particularly Wild Boy, is that in a way the sort of, earlier you talked about the kind of, there's a lot of hokey aspects of pop culture, California pop culture at that side. I mean, if you're going to, you're trying to make money, you're going to go out there and you're going to use some of the pop culture elements. But there's like this weird balance of like, a sense of whatever you want to call it, authentic spirituality, or like some guy who's really walking the talk, behind these kind of somewhat light, maybe even a little bit throwaway, if you're not listening to them closely, things that sound like other things. And it's actually kind of in a way more profound than if he was like, than if they were these incredibly, sophisticated, avant-garde, serious, intense, artistic kind of recordings, because that's usually the association you have with like the spiritual avant-garde. They're very serious and it's just like super intense, and they're going to push it to the edge. And here you get the sense of a kind of lightness that was, it seemed to me, part of the way that he lived his life, that even though he had a hard life and in some ways and obviously faced a lot of challenges living the way that he did, that what we think of as his spirituality is partly about a way of living, of being in life that has a kind of lightness or playfulness or a sort of ease that at least for me is very, it makes it a much more deep, it's a much deeper record than it necessarily initially sounds, or, collection.
I think he was a happy person. And I think particularly in the 1940s and 50s, that comes across particularly strong. He was married. He had a kid then. He was getting a lot of stuff recorded by Eartha Kitt and Sam Cooke, and Nat Cole was doing other versions, and Herb Jeffries from the Duke Ellington Orchestra. He isn't intense in the same way that we would consider the avant-gardist. I think you're right to say that. He doesn't have the schizophrenia of postmodernism. There's no irony or irreverence, even though I think in the 90s when, you know, postmodernism is sort of filtered down to the masses and a lot of that retro culture was coming back with, you know, tongue-in-cheek, he fit in with that. But if we try to read into his work kind of early self-awareness, i.e. the dominant postmodern trope, say in some of the really personal poems on Eden's Island, what we're really hearing is disillusion and a sense of Cold War era displacement, which you can make of it what you want, but clearly leftism and communism was in a state of crisis by 1960, having gotten itself so deeply at odds with the capitalist West and so inherently oppressive in its own territory. And I think Abi saw that fracture, that threat to idealism, and he offered an alternative to madness. And it could have been spiritual, it could have been funny, but and novelty, but I think he conflates all three of them. But he definitely wasn't ironic or irrelevant. He's a hopeful character, and I think that's really what he's trying to project. And if you really look at the 1960s before disillusionment really sets in, you know, by the early 70s, I think you get that same kind of optimism there.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I also want to ask about his sort of sense of Judaism, because, you know, he's raised in this, he's a very, you know, brought into the world in this intensely Jewish community, and, you know, hooks up with other wild and crazy Jews like good Gypsy Boots. And also there's the whole story about how the melody of Nature Boy was claimed to have come from a song from a Yiddish theater composer, and there was some settlement at some point. You know, I'd love to hear about that particular story, but more deeply about, do you think that he felt that there was a particularly sort of Jewish element to his spirituality? That did he think of himself in those terms, or did he really just kind of, once he, you know, was on his own, once he's on the trains, once he's in California, it's really not any more strong than any other element in his life?
One of his friends from the early 1970s told me when I interviewed him that he thought that Abi was essentially an esoteric Jew. Abi himself quoted Jesus Christ very much in his time, and he also referred to himself as the sound asleep, wide awake man of Zen. So I think in terms of spirituality, he draws on a lot of things that were already pretty well established in the culture: the long hair, the beard, the sandals, calling himself the prophet, calling himself the shepherd. So in a way, I guess, like Leonard Cohen, he kind of boils it down to its plastic and you know, mass producible element, and brings out that kind of everyman spirit of, you know, his Jewish past or his knowledge of spirituality. And you can listen to things like Nature Boy, like a song called Blessed Be the One that he did in 1979, like Palm Springs on the Wild Boy compilation, that are heavily inflected by Yiddish and klezmer melodies. Even some of his more, you know, novelty singles, like there was a single in 1963 called Mr. K, and it's based on just a regular klezmer beat. It's a silly song about a guy who drinks vodka and belches, you know, kind of in the Toxico wipeout, you know, style of the day. So I think whatever he learned musically early in the Hebrew schools stuck with him in terms of, like, you know, de facto mannerisms of his music. I mean, he always seemed to sort of fall back on those kind of ethnic and exotic elements, musically speaking. But in terms of his lifestyle or his beliefs, he was not really somebody that was pushing one religion over the other. In fact, he quoted one time as saying, "The gods of the earth are many, but the God of the sky is one, if any." And we've outgrown the idea of God because people hate each other and they kill each other and they teach their children to hate each other, you know. And so we don't need to be afraid to let those stupid old ideas go. And so I think that was really important to him, particularly in the last project that he was working on from 1975 to 1995 when he passed away. He was writing an autobiography and he was writing another book called The Scriptures of the Golden Age. And basically he was talking about the obsolescence of a lot of these antiquated ideas, you know, like religion. So he was really looking for something that was ecumenical and more of a brotherhood of man, I think.
What have you heard that the tune, the Yiddish theater tune, Hush My Heart or something like that? That
Schweig Mein Heart, yeah, I've heard it.
So is it a good case? Do you think that he said he heard the melody from the angels, and it sounds like he heard the melody from the angels. Do you have an opinion
if
you were on the jury trial, would you have awarded the guy the settlement?
No, I wouldn't have, but I think Irving Publishing was the one who forced Abby's hand on the settlement. I think he was fully ready to go to court if you read interviews from 1951 when it was about to go to trial. The fact is that Schweig Mein Heart by Herman Yabakov was staged in the Second Avenue Theater District, which was the Yiddish Theater District in 1935, 1936. It was never recorded. It was never released in any way. So for Abi to have heard it in some way, he would have either have had to have had the sheet booklet to the larger play, which was called Papyrosin, or he would have had to have been in the audience. Now, Yabakov does have a similar part. There's a line that somewhat mirrors that line, "There was a boy," that same melodic couplet there. Abi's is in 3/4, Yabakov's is in 4/4, but they do share some melodic similarities, the way the chords go up and then sort of descend, you know, sharply downward. But there's nothing else in the two songs that are related. More of the actual kind of ephemeral, you know, esoteric elements that you hear in Nature Boy, where it's just sort of floating without a, you know, real time signature or without a real tempo, is better found in Opus 82 by Antonin Dvorak, who took a lot of his melodies in the early 20th century from ethnic street melodies and folk melodies that he was, as a classical composer, going around and collecting throughout, you know, Bohemia and Hungary and all that area, Czechoslovakia. So, you know, that interest in the classical world and picking up folk melodies, you also get it in Stravinsky and The Rite of Spring. And so there was an interest in primitivism that was in fine arts. It was in literature, you know, it's in Cubism and Picasso and all that. So in the early 20th century, there is this interest in ethnic culture and folk culture. And I think eventually all those things from classical culture tend to filter down to the masses. And so by the time you get to Yabakov and you get to Abi, this is the period this is the real copyright explosion, and people are coming out of law school, and there's this whole new industry, the recording industry, and they're really, you know, descending upon these songwriters and making a tremendous amount of money, not only in you know, copywriting law, but also in going after each other. So, you know, at the time, there was, in 1948, when Nature Boy was a hit, I have articles of at least 20 different lawsuits that were dismissed of composers that were going after Eden for stealing the melody of Nature Boy. I mean, it seems that on some level, that kind of ethnic melody was bound to catch a few notes here or there. But I, you know, having now heard a recording of Schweig Mein Heart and placing it next to Nature Boy, almost every musician that I've talked to said the similarities are so vague, it's really hard to imagine that Yabakov would have won the case. But it was a $25,000 settlement, which was not huge considering that Nature Boy by 1951 had sold about 8.5 million copies and had been played on the radio zillions of times in many different versions. So, you know, I think in a way they sort of saw it as a way to, you know, you know, get this thing off their back quickly.
Sure,
without
sure. That makes sense. Well, that's good. That's good to know. Cause I didn't like that wrinkle in the tail. You know, we got about 10 minutes here left, and I wanted to ask you also a little bit about, collecting. I mean, you're a culture vulture. You're someone who really has spent a lot of your life, tracking these very obscure stories through lore, through interviews, through, you know, rare finds, et cetera, et cetera. What was the track on the new compilation that you put together? What was the track that you were kind of most surprising, or something you didn't know about, or one that kind of came out of nowhere, or that was so obscure you're surprised you even found it?
Well, half the songs were recorded by a gentleman named Bob Bertram, who lived in Southern California for a little bit and also lived in Hawaii in the mid-60s, and he recorded, you know, some Hawaiian bands. But he had died about 10 years ago, and his family up in Eureka, California, was getting rid of all his stuff. And so they basically were putting it out on the front lawn and getting ready to, you know, throw it in the dump. And so a woman who lived up there that just buys things bought all these boxes and started, you know, going through, and she saw about 20 things that were related, that had Eden's name written on them. And she got in contact with me through my website and basically offered them as, you know, here's something that was just about to be thrown away. Is this significant at all? And so, you know, Wild Boy really is half made up of something that, you know, was very nearly discarded for good. And, you know, that was the big thing. Once I found out about that stash, then I had to find a record company that was willing to put up the money to basically save it. I didn't have the money or the mechanism to get it out, you know, beyond just buying it here and storing it. And so, you know, they did the transfers. And then at that point, like, I had already had some other things in mind, like, because they were a big enough company, I wanted to get Eartha Kitt and Arthur Lyman and Nat King Cole and Ray Anthony, people that were on major labels. I wanted to get them mixed in so that you could kind of get a larger picture of what Eden had done. And then also the last three songs, Monterey and Overcomers of the World by John Harris, he had contacted me also through my website in 2011 and let me know that he had those. And Dave De La Vega, I had contacted him back in the late 90s, and he had the Clam Man. So, you know, like I said, I had about half in mind, but really the project came about when I found those Bob Bertram tapes that were, like I said, about to be thrown out in California.
It's amazing when those things happen, you know, when you just realize, like, how memory works, how cultural history works, how what physical objects do to hold our memories, and how tentative, you know, it can be, how close to oblivion a lot of things are. It's you know, really gives a lot of kind of motivation to the you know, cultural historians and collectors out there. You know, I'm also sort of curious, you know, so many people now are so tuned into the now, tuned into what's happening, whatever, you know, through social media, the latest. And what is your sense of how records like this go out? You know, this compilation of a fairly obscure figure, and they're pretty obscure songs, some of the names people know. You know, it's really a whole, you know, it's this marvelous little time capsule of this amazing character. But, you know, from a record company like Bear Family's perspective, or really just from your own sense of, like, what the value of these things have outside of the immediate circle of people who already know about Eden, what do you think's valuable about this kind of archaeology at this point in our, you know, hyper-saturated media environment?
Well, as Noam Chomsky said about the movement in the 60s, it was really a college movement, and now it's a global movement. It's a mainstream movement, and Abby represents the forefather of all that in many respects, and so I don't think it needs to be justified in that way. But, you know, in a larger context, I think, you know, albums like this, they get produced and they sort of just go out to the public, and you can kind of see where it goes. But with somebody as obscure as Eden, where really all we have is Nature Boy and Eden's Island to go on, you know, if you're going to put him in the same category of major psychedelic artists as the Beatles and Pink Floyd and Jimi Hendrix and the Cream and all that, you know, the onus is really on the producer to show, you know, how he fits into all that. And so what I wanted to do with this album was to grow the catalog, so that people could start to suss out what was the vocabulary musically and lyrically that was, you know, important to him that sort of led to the later and bigger movement. So, you know, they became more familiar if they had a bigger catalog to go on. Once you have, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 albums, then all of a sudden you can compare them to the giants of psychedelia. And so that was really the thing for me was, you know, I did an album in 2014 of a compilation of Eden's songs called The Exotic World of Eden Abbez, which was all rare independent Exotica singles of the 50s. So Wild Boy grows off of that by going into the unreleased catalog. And, you know, now we have, you know, 4 major things that people can get and they can listen to Eden. But, you know, I also don't think you can necessarily approach Eden 100% in kind of the John Ruskin critical way that you might, you know, just look at music. In a way, he's kind of like Modigliani in that the story and the art is sort of inseparable. So if you have these kind of, you know, critique, you know, things that you need to hit, I think Eden in some ways will miss that. Some of the novelty stuff will not have the greatest of melodies, you know, some of the things you go, oh, that's not as harmonically dense as Nature Boy. But for me, each little bit is a piece of the puzzle of his story and also of the bigger story of this counterculture movement and how music and the popular arts has affected social change in such a big way. You know, every little piece to me seems vitally important to kind of figuring it out. And so that's why, you know, I'm willing to go down the rabbit hole and look at the way in which there was this mainstream established culture of the 50s and early 1960s, and parallel to it was this budding movement. And here was this guy that was, you know, making all these little inroads one step at a time, but they eventually did pay off. And as we talked about earlier, a lot of the characters that were so vital in the late 1960s did embrace Eden, despite the fact that he didn't really make himself that available, you know. But like I met some of the members of the Source family, and they said it was really important to Jim Baker, their leader, that they pay homage to Eden and pay homage to Gypsy Boots. So a lot of the hippies in the late 1960s and early 70s were interested in meeting him and knowing him. And so in a way, maybe his work was already done up to that point. But now with albums like this, we can kind of see what were the first steps in the, you know, the larger movement that we all, you know, can exist in now. Whereas, yeah. You know, well,
you had mentioned that he was writing an autobiography and this other book on sub scriptures. What's happening with, are those texts out there? Are they lost? Are they will they ever be seen?
The autobiography was burned in a fire at the ashram that he was living at in the mid-1970s. The scriptures, there are a few versions of it that have trickled out. He read some of the poetic couplets or the proverbs on tape, and, you know, some people have photocopies of the different pages. But his last... you know, executor, as it were, or state trustee, David Janowiak out in Desert Hot Springs, was kind of against Eden's, universal spiritualism. And so he hired someone after Eden died to come in and change it and make it more Christian. And so we don't really know what state some of the pages are in. And it's really a shame, but there was some weird maneuvering that happened after Eden died, and, you know, different interests tried to reconstruct the story as they wanted. So my job as a historian has always been to try to peel away the onion and, you know, get at the center. But with regards to his writings and with a lot of other material that's still sequestered, you know, it's all a matter of time and persistence. So
do you think you have enough stuff that you'll put a book out on him?
I'm working on a biography right now. Yeah. So,
great. I'm really excited about it. You know, I have a lot of respect for your work. You know, really, you know, not just doing a superficial read, but really doing the archaeology and doing the cultural history. And you know, for me, people like Eden are very inspiring across the years, across the times. And so, you know, I really appreciate your work and recommend folks go and listen to Wild Boy, the Lost Songs of Eden Abes. Any other points you want to make about upcoming stuff or stuff for if people are interested, you want to check out further where they should go?
Well, there is a documentary that is being produced right now. I'm working with a documentarian named John Weiner, who's just finishing up a film about the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. So he's, you know, going back in time. And so we're hoping to finish that in the next few years. In the meantime, I do updates on my blog, and the blog is called Eden's Island. And it's a place where you can find out about, you know, updates and, you know, whatnot with regards to Eden. But that's about it right now. You know, I'm also working on the follow-up to Wild Boy with Bear Family. So that one will be pretty much focused on the 1970s and what Eden did. And it will be 100% unreleased material. So.
And what does the music sound like on that later stuff?
It's not exotica. It's more, you know, kind of pulls back on the novelty stuff, and it's much more very straightforwardly hippie. You know, there's one song on it called Emotion, which is a mantra, and a very powerful mantra at that. But it's just a synthesizer drone and Eden, you know, singing the same short phrase over and over again. And others are a little bit more, you know, moralistic or educational in terms of, you know, him trying to put together, you know, poetic or proverbial messages. But, you know, it is the same thing. I mean, you know, you can hear it if you follow it from Wild Boy, but, you know, he does kind of change with the times a little bit. So this is definitely, this next one will definitely be the one that is really, you know, a real hippie album, as it were.
Wonderful. I look forward to that even more as a particular fan of the 70s, which is my main zone of cultural archaeology and cultural history. Well, again, Brian, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind and talking to us about Eden Abes.
You're welcome. Thanks so much, Eric.
All right, great. Have a good day. And see, next week, what are we doing next week? We are talking to, God, I can't even remember now. Isn't that amazing how the brain fries at on Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Expanding Mind. But until then, keep your minds open.
Hey, I'm a child of nature. I'm happy and healthy and free. Yes, I'm in love with nature, and she's in love with me. I mean it from this heart of mine, nature can be so divine. I'm a child of nature, I'm happy and healthy and free. Hey, sunrise finds me high on a hill. Sunset, what a wonderful thrill. Moonlight, and I'm singing a song.